perception that one rejects that kind of exchange or communication, one will be left
not isolating individuals and simultaneously be sending a message, which I think is part of the ideological program of creating these roundtables, that the community itself is not oriented towards violence, is not part of a hardline tactic. And it, and I think that, that what's needed is sort of a growth or you know, a more concerted internal discussion of saying that one can be critical, one can be highly critical, and still, you know, espouse a perspective of nonviolence. And I think that that's the discussion that I don't think has evolved significantly over the last 10 years, but there needs to be specific attention brought to that. I think that's a very good point.
Yes, in terms of Jaggi's question, which is a really important one, I fully support the People's Commission campaign, and I think it's really important. But I think it's also really important to reflect on what the RCMP and CSIS have historically done when they try to interrogate or interview people. And there's soft ways they do this and much harder ways that they do this. But oftentimes the strategy, and we recount a number of these experiences in the book, The Canadian War on Queers, is they actually approach someone and say, you know, we've discovered that you might be a risk to national security because you're a homosexual. Clearly you must understand that you have to make a decision between loyalty to your friends or loyalty to your country. I mean, they actually pose it in these types of ways. And I think we have to really begin to deconstruct and tear apart these types of counterpositions. It's at the heart of national security to say that you're, you know, you're potentially a threat to the national security of this country. And if you're loyal to your friends, right, you're actually a risk to the national security of this country. And I think we actually have to begin to figure out concrete, practical ways of responding to that. I also think that we need a more broad-ranging campaign. I think this campaign is absolutely crucial, the campaign of non-cooperation with CSIS and getting more and more community and movement organizations to sign on to that, but to also put it in the context of problematizing CSIS much more generally. So it's not simple. So you produce a broader sort of educational, pedagogical, political context in which discussions about CSIS takes place. CSIS has no legitimacy. We should actually be trying to undermine entirely the legitimacy of CSIS. We do not want it to exist. It should not exist. That's one of the reasons why you should actually not cooperate with it. It's not doing anything to defend the security of your communities. It's actually putting the safety and security of people in your communities and in your movements in jeopardy. So it seems to me if we put that campaign in a broader context, there may be ways in which we can make advances. But I do think it's a really important campaign. I'm not aware of how much support it's got in the union movement. That's one potential place to actually start to get a much broader discussion around this, because if you get more unions signing on to this, that may actually be one way of trying to break into a broader framework of discussion. So those are just some observations in response to this really important question. Thanks.
I'd just like to say, like elaborating something I said earlier, I'm not concerned with being a good Canadian because I'm not a Canadian. That's the end of the day, you know. I can feel what you're saying, like how they would use that. What they do use against us is they try to scare us into believing that we're detrimental to the development of our community. But the only thing that's detrimental to the development of our community is them, and they've shown that time and again. And that's something I always say to the people in my community: just don't cooperate. Just don't fall into that trap, because they do that all the time. And my loyalties has always been to my people. When I say I'm not a Canadian, I don't even have a Canadian passport, and I refuse to get a passport because that's not who I am, you know. I don't know what else to say at that point. I'll just shut up and pass it on.
Ben, je l'ai dit quand je suis intervenue tout à l'heure que j'appuyais la non-collaboration avec la SRS. Je l'ai expliqué longtemps pourquoi, mais c'est ça. Je pense que c'est important de l'appuyer, entre autres, pour parce que si on se met à répondre, ça légitimise la SRS. Puis aussi, dans le fond, de ne pas répondre, c'est comme un peu boycotter quelque chose. faut que tout le monde embarque pour que ça arrête. Puis c'est ça. Je pense qu'en personne doit répondre en solidarité aussi avec les personnes qui sont le plus harcelées. Puis faut que ça soit un mouvement, pas seulement quelque chose d'isolé pour que ça marche bien.
We have many questions still, so I ask that you please keep your questions short.
I'm Chai Kaliwa. I live in Toronto, so I'm maybe not as well clued into the Montreal scene, but I am clued into the larger scene, perhaps. I like to sometimes introduce myself as the Indian that Columbus didn't find. And in that light, I would like to firstly thank my friend Clifton and his community for entertaining me after Oka in their community, which sort of speaks to, shall I say, shaking of hands over the planet. And if I may suggest that during G8 and G20 summit in Toronto, I had sent an email to my, how shall I say, email list, which basically said, let them eat oil, because as you remember, at that time, oil was raining in Louisiana. So when I sent that email out, within 24 hours, I had two cops visit me at my home. So that it gives you a sense of surveillance that existed in Toronto at that time. And I just wanted to bring that to your attention, because we should not live in a world where we think we are, so to say, free. Free for communication, free for assembly, free for everything else. The fact is, we are free under their overall surveillance. And that outlook should pervade perhaps all deliberations or whatever you might say. So my question to you is, how does this surveillance, overall surveillance, affected you personally in your life?
If we're all doing this, I mean, I know I was under surveillance. I mean, I was in the 1970s. I was a member of the Revolutionary Marxist Group. That they had a file on me. They had a desk in the RCMP in Ottawa. I do know that when my father, who worked for de Havilland Aircraft, was getting a security check because the government took over de Havilland Aircraft for a period of time, he was asked security-related questions about both myself and my sister. I'm not quite sure why my sister got drawn into the picture. I was very disappointed, though, when I actually applied to try and get my records when they claimed that they had nothing on me. So in terms of surveillance, I've seen lots of it. I've witnessed lots of it. I think I've been in organizations and in situations where informers have been present. Maybe I'll just mention one other thing. I was present at a convention of the Young Socialists, which was the youth wing of the League for Socialist Action in the 1970s, when the RCMP put down letters on everyone's chairs during the lunch break that basically alleged that one of the leaders of the League for Socialist Action was mentally unstable. And so, I mean, I've seen lots of the things that they do. I have to point out that I guess that I haven't been affected particularly detrimentally by these things, but certainly I've been directly impacted by them, and I certainly saw major policing operations at the G20 last June. So I'm sure people have more important things to say, so I'll stop there.
I don't know if I have any sort of thing significantly to contribute, but I did make a Privacy Act request from CSIS for my file. They would neither confirm nor deny whether they have anything on me.
Well, yeah, it has affected my ability to trust non-native activists and other people from other communities. I always have that little suspicion in the back of my mind. Are they really who they say they are? And it, yeah, it really flavors my relationships with people sometimes. But I'm at the point too right now. It's like I just don't give a fuck anymore. You know, it's like you got a file on me. I bet you have a this, that, and the other wiretap and surveillance and whatever. I mean, in my community, even my sense of privacy, just walking in the street. In 2004, we kept finding video cameras everywhere being planted on telephone poles. I mean, it was like London. We got us a dog. I mean, Christ, there's only 1,500 of us. I mean, what the hell? You know, it just, it does affect me a lot. It affects me a lot, and at the same time, it just like, I can't stop them from doing it. You know, I'm just going to do what I got to do. If you want to kill me, if you want to put me in jail, by all means, you know. I'll do the time. I'll do what I gotta do. Yeah, but I'm not gonna live as a slave. You know, I do what. That's what I tell people. Just be careful. If you don't want to get in trouble, don't do anything stupid. But just be who you have to be. You have to live. I'm not gonna stifle my vision, my descent, or my life. You know, that's how it's affected me. It has to a point, and then at the same time, it's made me so pissed off that it's like I don't. You know, I really don't care what they think or what they see or what they know.
Moi, personnellement, d'avoir été visé par le CRS, ça ne m'a pas, disons, traumatisé ou affecté psychologiquement. J'ai eu d'autres problèmes avec la police qui m'ont plus affecté que ça dans ma vie personnelle, des procès, des choses comme ça. Mais c'est sûr que c'est dans le milieu militant, soit les visites de CRS ou l'infiltration, parce que ça arrive souvent qu'on découvre des infiltrateurs. Dans le fond, ça augmente la paranoïa, puis ça, dans le fond, c'est ça. Comme tu disais aussi, ça nous fait perdre la confiance en les gens. C'est ça, on a toujours des doutes, surtout après le G20, on a entendu qu'il y avait beaucoup d'infiltration. Donc, je pense que pour moi, c'est plus de ce côté-là que ça m'affecte. On sait qu'on est écouté, qu'on est suivi, on ne peut plus parler, on n'ose plus parler de ce qu'on fait, même à des personnes que, dans le fond, on se dit une personne qui est safe, c'est quelqu'un que je connais depuis 10 ans ou des choses comme ça. Donc, je pense que c'est plus de ce côté-là que moi, ça m'a affecté.
Merci. On va prendre la prochaine question, mais il ne reste pas beaucoup de temps, donc s'il vous plaît, faites vos questions courtes.
Oui, bonsoir tout le monde. Et je m'appelle Alex Bornheim. Je vis à Montréal. J'apprécie beaucoup votre forum social et votre panel dans cette circonstance politique. Je voulais poser une question à la prisonnière. Pourquoi vous avez été arrêté? Est-ce que c'est parce que vous avez été deux fois en Palestine? Ou du moins parce que vous avez participé aux manifestations de GV? Est-ce que dans les cellules de la prison, est-ce que vous avez subi des sévices ou des humiliations?
Pour avoir été en Palestine, je n'ai pas été arrêté, mais j'ai eu des problèmes là-bas. Dans le fond, à l'aéroport, des choses comme ça, en rentrant et en sortant. Mais pour le G20, j'ai été arrêtée à cause que quelqu'un avec qui je me promenais sur la rue avait un mandat d'arrestation pour le complot. Donc, j'étais arrêtée avec les autres pour le complot aussi, mais j'étais accusée d'avoir des armes à cause de choses que j'avais dans mon sac. Puis, j'ai perdu mes accusations parce que la preuve contre moi pour justifier mon arrestation, il devait donner la preuve du complot dans mon cas, puis cette preuve-là est gardée assez secrète. C'est juste les avocats puis les personnes accusées qui ont le droit de l'avoir, c'est pas public. Donc, ils préféraient pas nous la donner que de continuer le procès. J'ai été assez chanceuse au G20 parce que, comme j'ai été dans les premières arrêtées, j'ai pas été dans la prison quand il y avait comme 1000 personnes en même temps. Donc, j'ai pas été bien traitée, mais j'ai été une des personnes les mieux traitées, disons. Fait que c'est ça.
Merci. I'll take the next question, please.
Hi, my question is for Yavar. I was just wondering, as a lawyer working on security certificate cases specifically, and specifically on one case with Mr. Raju, you know, how do you, first, do you feel it's ever even possible to win a security certificate case? You'd mentioned that Mr. Sherkawi and Mr. Almarai's cases are over now, but CSIS and the government never admitted that they were wrong in those cases. They never admitted that the men were innocent. In Sherkawi's case, they just withdrew the evidence. So, do you feel that it's possible to win these cases? And, you know, how do you feel working with your clients, trying to defend your clients in a system that you know is fundamentally flawed? Do you ever fear that by defending your clients that you may be legitimizing a process that is unfair to begin with? Does that ever go through your mind? How do you feel working on these cases?
These are all the very good questions. I do very much feel like that I'm part of a fundamentally flawed process. The process, as you know, has been patched over by the advent of special advocates. It is still a highly imperfect process, and you're right. It's a compromised position where the role of lawyers for the concerned person are there basically trying to facilitate some justice for that person, and I think that there is a role to play, but the process is fundamentally unfair, and I can go into at length, if you like, the injustices in Mr. Manjoub's case. What I will say is that can one ever really win the case? I think that technically speaking, of course, if the certificate is found not to be reasonable, then that's sort of the end of the process. But I guess what you rightly raise is that, is the process ever really at an end? Can the certificate be reinvoked in the future? I mean, that's a possibility. The other thing is that the individual lives with the specter of these allegations hanging over them. I think that the best thing that we can try to do in this kind of process is to play by the rules, to attempt to defeat it under its rules, and there's a prospect for that. I don't know in the case of Mr. Manjoub, I think there's some potential for it, but as we saw with the certificate of Mr. Harkat, beyond reason, beyond evidence, beyond everything that we might think is the case, we can find that the certificate is justified on the basis of secret evidence. So there are these real sort of contradictions in the process. And the only thing that I could say is that, as a lawyer and also as communities working in solidarity with the concerned person, we must try to do everything we can at our disposal to try to find justice. In Mr. Manjoub's case, underlying, I guess, sort of your point is that what he feels currently is that although he is not in physical detention, he is being monitored 24 hours a day. There are video cameras in his home. There's video cameras outside of his home. And so this, in a sense, is at least a tangible thing that we can try to attack. But make no mistake, the fact that he's not physically in detention doesn't mean that the state does not have its tentacles watching him at all times. So if we can do something to at least reverse that process, to do what was done to in Mohammed Harkat's case, what was done in Nader Sharkawi's case, to gain some liberty and at least some dignity for him to live without these restrictions, I think that would be a victory in itself.
My name is Marion, and I'm with the Canadian Union Postal Workers. And I really want to thank the panelists because I've learned a lot. But I have a question about the focus just on CSIS. It seems to me that when Yavar talked, you talked about the Border Services Agency. We know that there's a Canadian Security Agency. We know that there's a whole Canadian security apparatus. There's a security certificate. There's a new changes to the Immigration Act. So I just want to know politically why the focus is on CSIS and not sort of the general security apparatus, because for me it's I understand it's a political choice, but I just need some sort of rationale as to why we're making that choice rather than talking about the establishment in general. Because even if we, for instance, disbanded CSIS, we'd still have a huge security apparatus. So I guess that's my question.
Marie-Ève, who's one of the organizers, is going to respond to that question, and then maybe some of the panelists will want to add something.
As an organizer of like Tatiana said, as an organizer of the weekend, as you can see in the program, like CSIS, we recon and we know that CSIS is only one tentacle, like Yavar just named it, is one tentacle of the of this whole security agenda system. So that is why also during the weekend, if you maybe Tatiana, you can say the which exactly, because I don't have the program in neither in my head, neither in front of me. But over the weekend, there will be the virtual walking tour of the Montreal le complexe militaro-sécuritaire à Montréal. Il y aura également d'autres panels et d'autres ateliers qui élargissent également et qui parlent des autres aspects de cet agenda sécuritaire au-delà de juste les SCRS. Donc, c'est ça.
Would any of the panelists like to add anything?
I think Marianne's question is really important. Obviously, CSIS is part of a web or network of a national security regime that we need to challenge in a whole bunch of different ways. And I think the conference is organized in ways that actually begin to map out some of those relationships. I do think we need more work on their interconnections. And we also need to figure out where the weak points are. And I'm not sure whether we should be focusing on CSIS or some other area right now. But if we can identify what the weak links are, where the crises of legitimacy could be opened up and expanded in the best possible ways, we may wish to move forward on those at the same time as understanding that we need to maintain our criticism of all of the other security aspects. I mean, just to look back at what happened with the RCMP and the transition to CSIS, one of the things that happened is popular movements exposing what the RCMP actually did created a legitimacy crisis that in some ways the state was able to relatively successfully resolve in its favor when it formed CSIS, right? So how can we prevent something like that happening again? For instance, if we did decide, let's go forward with a major campaign against CSIS, and somehow we actually win, but what they do is another administrative process where another security force gets put in place. We need to be prepared. We need to learn from history and to be prepared for that, but also to understand that in the past people have been able to act and to do things. The government didn't want to get rid of the RCMP security service, right? They would have preferred for it to stay in place. But we, people, movements, force them to actually bring about changes. So it's also important for us to recognize our power and our capacities, but also that we have to be vigilant. Even if we think we're winning a victory, like we've thought we've won around the national security certificates at points, and we have won important gains, we need to always be vigilant about how they can come back on us on other fronts of the national security regime. So we need to develop a sort of more global strategy of resistance to the national security regime in all of its different manifestations. Thanks.
I think it's pretty evident, you know, it's not even CSIS, RCMP, SQ, whatever. It's the system. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter what dismantling of any organization, you still have that greater system, which is the government and the ideology behind that government. I mean, as Native people, we've been trying to dismantle this for over 300 years. You know, we've been victims of it, so we know what it is. And, you know, that's what it is. It's the system that relies on the exploitation of poor, you know, the dispossession of indigenous populations. That's what it is. So I like that question that you had asked. And, you know, that's purely what it's about. And if we want to dismantle, I think we've got to dismantle the state. That's the thing that I think is in the way.
If I can just add to that, I think that one thing that's important about the campaign against CSIS sort of involved with that is the attack on secret information, secret trials, closed processes, the gathering of information through covert methods. If we can, to the extent possible, create more transparency in our legal and judicial processes, I think that this is something that we would all want. And so in that sense, CSIS may be scaled back, replaced with something, but if the net result is that we can eliminate or pare back this kind of secrecy in terms of these state processes, we will have more fair processes that we can deal with on the evidence, and we can push back this sort of fear mongering and ideological agenda.
Alors, j'aimerais remercier tous nos panélistes aujourd'hui. C'était une discussion très informative qui porte à la lumière que la surveillance, la répression, l'harcèlement, l'intimidation, le profilage, l'infiltration, c'est des choses qui sont vécues à travers plusieurs communautés, que ce soit chez les gays, les lesbiennes, chez les militants anticapitalistes ou en solidarité avec la Palestine, que ce soit chez les peuples autochtones ou chez les communautés arabes, musulmanes et à statut précaire. Dans le contexte de la soi-disant guerre contre le terrorisme et l'agenda sécuritaire, on est tous ciblés. Et puis, on veut continuer à avoir cette discussion, à continuer à tisser des liens. Et donc, on vous invite à participer à l'atelier cet après-midi. C'est l'atelier qui aura lieu à 15h30 ici. Sur justement élaborer ces stratégies et continuer à renforcer nos luttes. Alors, encore une fois, je vous remercie à tous d'être ici aujourd'hui. Et puis, je vous invite à partager le dîner avec nous. Il y aura un dîner qui sera servi dans quelques minutes gratuitement. Et puis, d'être avec nous toute la fin de semaine, même demain soir, où il y aura un souper en solidarité avec Mohamed Arkat. Et aussi, il y aura, je crois qu'il y a une note qui est envoyée par M. Majoub, dont Yavar parlait tantôt. Une note qui nous va être lue de M. Majoub, dont on vous demande de rester avec nous de la fin de semaine et de vous amuser. Merci.
That was CSIS, who leads the panel discussion at the People's Commission.